Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Arvid Kahl, author of the Bootstrap Founder blog, and we're going to talk about continuous validation, meaning making sure that your product still holds up to multiple criteria over time. This episode is brought to you by Nusi, proposal software made easy for creatives. Do you get stressed every time a new lead hits your inbox? Nusi was built to help you create, send, track, and manage your proposals in one easy-to-use app. Forget about searching for your best content and following up with clients to sign on the dotted line. Visit nusi.com/UIBreakfast for a 30% discount on your first 3 months. Hey, Arvid.
Hello. Hi there.
Hello. Thank you for joining us today.
That's wonderful.
Before we get started, let's learn a bit more about yourself, your background story, and your amazing success exit story with Feedback Panda that we all observed and watched and clapped along.
All right. Well, I'm a software engineer by trade. I've been doing this for a good part of a decade and I guess a few years more, I guess. Yeah, I founded Feedback Panda, which is my most recent project, with my girlfriend and business partner, Danielle. Around 3 years ago, we built a SaaS business for online English teachers. Within 2 years, we grew that to $55,000 MRR, and then we sold it to a private equity company just a couple weeks before the two-year anniversary. It was a crazy ride. It was probably my fourth or fifth bootstrapped software project that I've been part of, and the first one to actually succeed. So that was good. But I had a lot of other software development experiences in the past. I worked for a VC-funded software company in the Silicon Valley, for a couple of German companies as a regular software engineer in companies that are as German as it gets, and in startups that I founded that had no funding and some funding. And so I've been all over the place. But this one, for the first time, was a completely bootstrap business, a product that we needed ourselves and that had a really niche audience and was very successful in that.
So you once again prove the point that there is no overnight success. And I didn't quite know that it was your fourth or fifth business. That's a lot. So maybe you could give us a recap of what these were.
So there was a lot of businesses that never made it past the idea and prototype stage because I founded them essentially myself and never really released it. That's the kind of inhibition you have as an engineer that is also a perfectionist when it comes to the technical part. And I think lots of software engineers and people that are highly technical will understand that you always find something else you want to do in your product. And you always want to do one more thing before you release it. And I think even with a product that already has paying customers, you do this with certain features. You want to make them perfect. You want to make them like the best they can be. And you forget to release and to actually give value to your customers. So I had that like two or three times with just software engineering products by myself, a software engineer for other software engineers, because that's the audience I knew at the point. Two other projects that are not for software engineers stand out. One of them failed horribly because we did no marketing. Was a photojournalism application that I founded or co-founded with a friend and another friend. We built a cool product, was a nice prototype. We had one paying customer, and then we forgot to do marketing. One of these weird things where everybody was kind of technical, and the person that was or should have been responsible for the marketing had other things to do because it was also like a side gig for them. So it turns out that if you don't put your product into the actual community, into the market where it could be bought, nobody's going to buy it. So that happened. That was the project that didn't go too far. And the other one that kind of went somewhere but pivoted was a local food platform that I was part of here in Berlin that I co-founded with a couple friends. One of them had a background in agriculture. One of them was a designer. And then me as a technical part. We built our product for, I think, the better part of a year. We just built and built and built and built. And here's another feature. And here's the thing that they're probably going to like. I'm saying that they're probably going to like because we never validated it with any of our audience. And it was a marketplace. So we had two sides, right? We wanted to have the farmers surrounding Berlin, the city where I live, that were to then sell their food into the city to the other half of our audience, which were the foodies in Berlin. And we neither validated it with the farmers nor with the foodies. It was a complete disaster. It didn't go anywhere. We also had a marketplace. It's getting weirder and weirder now that I think about it. But we had a marketplace that had no payment options, like that kind of stuff, right? That was a startup that I was part of, pivoted since to a more like a food subscription box model for B2B. I'm still part of the ownership team, but I don't work for it anymore. So I consider it a failed business on my end. It's still kind of surviving, but by far not as much as Feedback Panda did, which we grew from essentially zero to mid six-figure annual recurring revenue business within 2 years. That is just insane compared to the other two things.
Since we're going to be talking about validation, customer validation, can you give us a bit more context who the audience is for Feedback Panda and how you decided to choose them as an audience for your product and how that took off so rapidly that, I mean, 2 years to an exit and to such great MRR is definitely not a conventional growth rate for bootstrap SaaS.
Yeah, definitely not. Unless, and I've seen this in others too, multiple things happen at the same time. So I'm going to try to answer this in reverse, because I think the last point, like why we grew so fast, is one of the most important ones. Education technology, which was the industry that we were in with the business, is usually a super hard field to sell anything to. Like schools are, they don't have a budget. There's a lot of regulation and you can't sell to like schools without going through a year-long sales process. It's just crazy. And we found that a lot in the community here in Berlin. There's a lot of startups that want to help schools and want to help education, but they can't because nobody has money to actually pay. So that is crazy. But for us, we were in the lucky position that I guess just by coincidence, Danielle, my partner, she injured her legs and couldn't leave home and needed to find some way to make money. And she found this online English teaching job that was facilitating Native American English speakers. So like Americans that natively speak English, maybe that's more precise, teaching Chinese children English over the internet. That was essentially the job. And there was this gigantic tectonic shift, this wave in the Chinese education market facilitating online learning, where before after school tutoring, which this was, right, English, like learning English after school, was a very local, a very face to face kind of business. Now it turned into this online thing. And all of a sudden, with the Chinese internet infrastructure improving and even remote places having a connectivity that was enough for some sort of face-to-face online communication, the market just exploded. Like from nothing, there was all of a sudden like tens, dozens, then hundreds of these companies that would facilitate teaching something over the internet to Chinese kids. And of course, if you want to teach a language, you take the people who speak it natively, and that's Canadians, Americans, South Americans, British people, like everybody who speaks English kind of can just get that job by the virtue of them speaking the language. So that market just exploded. They were recruiting these people like crazy. And Danielle was one of the people who were recruited by these Chinese companies. So she was starting to teach. And at that point, there was like 10,000 teachers working for this one company alone over the internet. A year into that, there was 25,000 teachers working for this company alone. And shortly before we sold, there were 75,000 teachers working for this company. So that was the growth pattern that happened in the industry that we were working for. That wasn't necessarily even our doing. Like, there was just them growing, because all of a sudden, the infrastructure, the technology, the availability of computers, the mobile saturation in China, it all came together and allowed for that market to exist and just grow. So we noticed that market existed. So that was one part, right? Now, let me answer the other two parts. Danielle had a problem because she was teaching so much that there was a lot of bureaucracy, additional work that she needed to do that was not teaching. And if you ever have seen a teacher, the thing they like to do is actually teaching. They don't like to grade tests. They don't like to prepare stuff. They just want to teach because that's the essence of their job. And for these online teaching things, Danielle and every other teacher working for this company had to do student feedback. After each 25 minutes of a lesson, which is a one-on-one lesson with a Chinese student, she would need to write 3 or 4 paragraphs of text about the actual lesson. How did the student do? What can they improve? Like, how could they prepare for next lesson? And with this being China, the curriculum was completely dictated by the Chinese company. So there was no difference in lessons between one child or the other. You would teach the exact same stuff. And anybody who has worked in IT or has been building like SaaS products knows that automation is one of the most powerful things you can help people with, right? Automating tedious tasks. Danielle found such a tedious task, and that was student feedback. So that was the thing that she needed solved. She came to me, showed me her problem, and said, can we do something about this? And I said, sure, because it was mostly text, and text can be templated. So we built a templating system for student feedback. And I built that for her because she had that problem. Like every single day, she would do 2 extra hours of work that was unpaid, but she needed to do it to even get paid for teaching, just writing the student feedback. And every other teacher in the market had the exact same problem. And there was 10,000 already that we knew had this problem when we figured out that this was something that we could solve. So that answers, I guess, the second part. And now coming to the actual audience, extremely niche. It was an extremely niche audience. I think we talked about this whole thing briefly at MicroConf Europe just in October last year at an attendee talk that we had. And Danielle had this one slide with like 8 bullet points of the niche of our audience, right? It was online teachers speaking English natively, teaching Chinese children English, English as a second language, through web-based applications, and a couple other more things. It was super niche, right? It was an extremely niche audience that we had, but we knew that they all had the exact same critical problem, which was these 2 extra hours a day. And once I built the prototype, and Danielle figured out this was actually saving so much time for her, like she turned the 2 hours into 5 minutes, which for something you have to do every day is quite significant. We knew that there was a business right behind there. And then we turned it into a business. We allowed people to sign up, gave them a 30-day trial, and charged them $10 a month because, after all, they're English teachers teaching online, so they usually don't make much money. So $10 a month was the initial price that we had for our highest tier. We've since increased that to 15 a year after. So we did a 50% price increase. That worked surprisingly well. And yeah, that's the business in a nutshell.
I'm super happy for you that you found that trend and have been able to convert it into a successful business. Now let's talk shop. So continuous validation. Why I brought up this topic is because I found a great article of yours in the blog, which of course I'm going to link to in the show notes. And we think that validation is something that happens in the beginning of the business. But the angle you're taking with that is that it needs to happen all the time. And it's about the journey, not the beginning of it. So how did you arrive at writing this article, and what triggered those thoughts for you? And what do you think the angle was that you were coming from?
I think, like most of my blog posts, this kind of originated from a Twitter conversation that I was having with somebody, because people were asking like, yeah, is it enough to validate just your initial thing? Or how do you deal with like shifts in the market or changing customers' requirements and all these things? And I thought, did I do this? Like, did I actually think of that stuff later in the business? Or did I just do it in the beginning? And I figured out just in retrospect, because after actually selling the company, I had a lot of time to think and actually reflect on what we did. Because some of the things you do while you build a business are just almost instinctive things that you've picked up over the years. So I finally got an opportunity to reflect on what we did. And in fact, we did reflect on this, why we're running the business. So we had some sort of non-quantified, but still existing continuous validation built into our business, because every now and then we would go into the kind of feature request lists that we collected throughout the months of running the business, because every single day some user would write in and say, well, I kind of need this, or this doesn't work too well for me, can we change it? So we had this whole list of feature requests, and we used that time not only to look into the feature requests, but also into the general sentiment of, is the company going the right way? Are we still solving the problem that we actually set out to solve? Is that even still a problem? All these kind of questions we asked ourselves every, I guess, couple months, like maybe 4 or 5 months. Didn't really have a day for that, but we just did it whenever there was enough in the feature request list accrued. So we had a good opportunity to spend a meeting on it, I guess. So we did this. And then later, when I had this conversation on Twitter, I figured out, yeah, maybe it's time to actually quantify this into like a meaningful kind of collection of steps that you can take, because this has been really helpful. Because not only did we figure out that we were still solving the problem we set out to solve, or if the problem changed, we also figured out that we would still need to want to work in a business. After a while, sometimes you do so much work in a business that it kind of feels like it's overwhelming. Every day is the same, and every day you're solving problems. Are you even still interested in solving these kind of problems? That is a question that if you don't ask yourself this regularly, you at some point might just feel depressed or burned out. And it just, there's no more love for your audience. There's no more love for solving a problem. So if you don't correct for this quickly enough, the whole business is in danger. That's why I wrote the article, because I felt we did this and it helped us survive even through the hard phases of this business, which still existed, right? It was great with the growth and everything, but there was still a lot of heartache. There was a lot of stress in running this business because it was always just Danielle and I. Even with over 5,000 customers in the end, it was just her and I like manning our customer service desk, building new features, designing new features, making sure that people could actually use them. All of this had to happen in essentially 48 hours a day because it was just the two of us. So we needed to validate that we were still onto the right thing so that we could course correct. And that's why I wrote it.
So the first angle you are talking about in the article is various risks of becoming misaligned. Like if you were, even if you had a product market fit in the beginning, still all kinds of market forces, circumstances, anything else might come into force. So what are these? And have you been able to face any of them in real life when you were working on Feedback Panda?
Definitely. So the yeah, every single day, but some of them were stronger than others. So it's a good opportunity to talk about it. Sure. The first one I think is always this problem solution alignment. Like first check, is the problem still the problem that you set out to solve? Like I have now said four times, like when you founded your company, you wanted to solve a certain problem. Are you still solving this? Or did the problem shift away? Like did it change in its nature? And that did change for us. I'm going to talk about this in a second. And is the solution that you currently have still aligned to that, right? Is your product that is currently out there solving this problem that your customers have? And that was interesting because we had a browser extension in our product. Our whole product was essentially a SaaS, like a web-based application where people could essentially have a database of their students and the lessons they taught and the feedback they gave, just like a glorified Excel sheet in a way, but with a lot of interactions between the data that were specific to this education technology segment of online English teachers. So it was a very specific professional tool for these teachers. And their main problem was always writing feedback, but that changed over time because the schools themselves, these online English schools in China, they had different requirements. In the beginning, they wanted people to, I guess, just write free text about what they taught and what the students should be doing for the next lesson, how they should prepare. But a couple months into that, they changed their system to give feedback into a free text and three radio buttons, essentially checking like a rating. Like how would you rate your student in terms of fluency? How would you rate your student in terms of attendance, like attention, these kind of things. So they changed the system that the teachers would need to use to get feedback. So we had to react to this and we had to allow people to use our system for multiple schools because all of a sudden, after a couple months, people didn't only want to use the software with our system or our software with their school they were teaching. There was new schools in the market that they also were teaching for. You have to understand that the online English teachers are essentially Uber drivers for online English teaching, right? They're contracted out to Uber, but they might also drive for Lyft or whatever kind of weird taxi business exists out there. So there was all these different schools they were teaching for, but they all had to give feedback, but in different ways. So we needed to adjust our product so it wouldn't only solve the problem for half of them, because there was now all these new teachers coming in teaching for different schools, but to be adaptable and allow them to use the product for all the kind of employers that they were working for at the time. Back to the browser extension. We had a browser extension that would integrate with the classrooms that the teachers had. And these were web-based portals, right? Essentially, like Google Docs or something is a web-based portal. People would teach through a browser with a video stream in there. It was like Skype in a browser, essentially. And they had complicated systems, so we tried to make it easier by just putting a little panda button right into their classroom where they could click on it and would open our application and they would be able to do the student feedback much quicker, much easier. So I wrote a browser extension, which is great because in Chrome and Mozilla Firefox and then even Microsoft Edge, surprisingly, you can put browser extensions in there with relative ease. Safari, different story. That always was kind of the neglected child in this group. But I built that and it worked super well. People had the button in there and they could stop teaching, immediately click it, and everything was fresh in their mind. And it was great. It was a great part of our application that we didn't sell because we didn't really sell the browser extension, right? We sold access to our service on the website. Browser extension was just an extra. And then the Chinese suddenly figured out that Adobe was sunsetting Flash. And Flash was the technology that they used to do the video instead of using HTML5 video, which is the thing that YouTube uses. They still had this kind of 90s technology going on with Adobe Flash for the video stream. And all of a sudden, they were trying to figure out, oh my God, like at the end of 2020, there will be no more Flash. We have to change everything because the whole video system is not going to work anymore. So what they did was the weirdest thing. Instead of updating their technology to use HTML5, they said, okay, we're just going to freeze your browser version in time so it won't ever remove Flash by wrapping it up in an Electron app, like essentially putting a browser in a box and shipping that as an application that people had to install. And then accessing their website through this app. The weirdest thing. And that was such a shift for us because all of a sudden we could not install the browser extension anymore. Because a browser extension needs a running browser that can actually facilitate extensions. And inside an Electron app, you cannot install it. So half of the value of our business was kind of in the air. And it took me a couple of weeks to figure this out, but we built another application that would inject a browser extension into their weird application. It was super complicated technology in the end, and not going to go into detail, but that was one of these things. Had we not understood that the behavior of our customers, how they use their teaching portal changed, our solution to the problem would have not solved the problem anymore, right? Because the browser extension as an integral part didn't solve the problem of making it easy to use our product if it could not be installed. So that's the problem solution alignment problem there.
It's not like one of those businesses, a classic example when you rely on Twitter API and then Twitter closes an API. That's too much of a textbook in your case. A web application stopped being a web application, essentially, and started being a wrapped up desktop app, right?
And it was still a web application. And that was the weirdest thing to me because you could still access their portal from a browser. They would just kind of check which browser you were using, like from the user agent headers or something, and figure out, like, were you coming through Chrome or were you coming through the application, and then forbid you to use the video function if you were coming through a regular browser, which for any slightly technically minded person, it's not a problem to circumvent. But for most of our teachers who were not techies, right, they were just like trying to use the technology that they needed to use to do their job. It was an insurmountable problem and they needed to install this installable thing. So yeah, in a way, they only changed kind of the access through which you could actually do your work. But that is a significant impact on the workflow of our teachers. And that threw us a pretty interesting challenge at that point. And those things can appear out of the blue, right? Like a technology shift like this. And if you look at it, like the dependencies there, Adobe said that they would not support Flash anymore by end of 2020 in 2015. That's when they announced it. And then the Chromium team, not even the Chrome team, just the Chromium team, the people building the engine on which Chrome then is constructed, they said, okay, now we kind of need to migrate this out of our product. So they had a roadmap going on and people just forgot like which roadmap is more accurate and where they should follow. All of a sudden, Chrome was just saying, well, Flash is going to be gone in a couple months in this one big banner in the browser, which some people probably still see now because they're not done phasing it out yet. That's still a couple months from now. But they displayed the banner and that freaked out these Chinese companies. So they immediately reacted with the worst kind of thing they could do instead of changing their technology. And it was hilarious. But yeah, these things, you just don't know they're coming. So you have to consistently validate that you're actually still solving your problems because you never know what could be coming your way.
I imagine it's already like a year back and you're still super passionate about this. I imagine your hair on fire when it actually happens. I don't even want to know. So you mentioned, the platform changes, the circumstances changing for your customers. Did you always learn about this from incoming conversations, or did you do anything proactive to learn about changing circumstances?
Initially, we only learned of these things through the community itself. That meant either incoming customer service conversations or us actually encountering these things in the Facebook groups and on Twitter, wherever, Instagram mostly, wherever our customers actually were hanging out. There was a lot of buzz in the community because teachers are a very interesting audience. They love to share. They love sharing information. They love sharing, actually teaching other teachers how to teach. There's a lot of meta stuff in there. So they would talk about all these things that they found almost indiscriminately in these kind of communities just to make sure that everybody was aware of what was going on. So we found it in there too. And then at some point, I understood that I could be proactive about it. So I built a little tool that would actually scan the asset servers where new versions of software were deployed by these Chinese companies for new versions. So I could be automatically alerted if there was a new version coming that I might need to actually adjust the browser extension or our integration to. So there was I needed to build some kind of tools, but mostly it came in through people who were telling us that they've been rolling out this change and your browser extension doesn't work anymore. Can you help me? Which is really, really anxiety and stress inducing if you're sitting in your father-in-law's home at 2 a.m. and somebody's telling you that the browser extension doesn't work for thousands of people. Like that kind of stuff, if you're not prepared for that, that can easily drive up your anxiety, which it did for me. So I needed to build these kind of automated systems to make sure that I knew first before anybody else knew that something was going on.
So this is a whole spectrum ranging from incoming information to passively scoring the forums to being proactive, like the tool that you built. There was also other talks at MicroConf that was pretty inspiring for me, where the recommendation was to schedule planned calls with your existing customers to sort of audit the ways that they're using the app, to check the features that some of the features they're using, some of they're not, and then have sort of customer success conversations without any underlying problem background. So have you been doing any of that, or what was your primary channel for a user interaction about this?
So we never schedule things. So I also listened to the talk and I found it very interesting. And had I still had the company at that point, probably would have done it. But we kind of used the opportunities where they came up. We had a lot of customer service conversations that were coming in that turned into these kind of exploratory validation conversations because we used our time to actually talk to our customers after they reached out about a billing issue or about a bug that they found, which was rare because usually bugs, we would retrieve them through our error detection system or just error reporting Sentry or whatever you have that kind of finds the bugs as they appear in real time and tells me. So I would often fix bugs before people could even reach out about them, which was great. But when they did, I used the opportunity, and Danielle did that too, to just chat with people. To just, okay, so how is it going? Like, are you happy with the software? Are you using this feature we released that a couple months ago or a couple weeks ago? Is that something that you regularly use? We kind of use that for a more informal kind of validation to get a feel of how our customers felt about the product. We didn't really release too many features that were super wild. Like our product was always more the scalpel kind of product, solving one problem really well, which was student feedback. There wasn't too much else. We never ventured into the adjacent products that we could have built because teachers have a lot of problems. Like the education technology market is hilariously underserved. There's a lot of problems still there that nobody is solving, like payment tracking if you work for multiple different schools, or just regular student management, like course management, content management for things that you teach that are not given to you by your school, like curriculum-wise. There's a lot of tools that are still not built so that could solve these kind of problems, but we chose not to because we wanted to provide a tool that solves this one problem so well that everybody kind of has to use it instead of solving many problems well enough that you have alternatives. And when I talk about alternatives, I'm also talking about alternatives that are not competitors, but just like other tools like Excel or piece of paper and a pen, right? If that is more efficient than my tool, then I'm doing something wrong. So we wanted to build the most efficient tool to solve that problem.
Your app was primarily sort of B2C, is it the right way to put it? So we are dealing with a very large number of users, mm-hmm. like thousands, right? Correct?
Yeah.
So I wonder if you ever translated those qualitative insights as per like how does it feel in the community into any kind of quantitative data. Did you make sure that if you spoke to 50 users, they represented well another 50,000 users that were remaining silent at the point?
I would say we probably could have done this better to begin with. Like, this is not the perfect approach. But whenever we talk to somebody on our customer service platform, we always had a lot of enriched data that we send from our servers into these kind of platforms. We were using Intercom at the time. And whenever somebody would reach out to us, we would know exactly like who they are in our platform. Like, we would put up or transmit information about how many records they have in our database. How many students do they teach on average? How many student feedbacks do they give in a day? Which can give you a good insight what kind of group they fall in, right? Are they beginners? Are they experts? Are they people who've been with us for a year and have really used the product well? Or are they still in their first couple of days of that trial? We had all this information, so we could always enrich the kind of conversation we had on our side with insight into how valid is this in their part of a journey that they're on, right? Like, at the trial, people had completely different problems and they had completely different even expectations of the product than people that have been with us for 2 years that have seen the product evolve in a certain pace. So they know what's going to happen and what's not going to happen to the product. So I guess having additional information, that was our quantifying approach, right? We never really did a survey or try to grab the whole group of our customers because we felt this was a bit intrusive. And we knew that the people that we were talking to were super busy and easily ticked off. Super busy because that was not only a job that is hard, because being active in front of a camera every single day for 10 hours is a lot. You have to motivate Chinese children that don't really speak English well by just like flinging your arms and singing songs and like playing with toys. That is hard to do for 10 hours straight. But the other problem is it's evening in China. So that means it's early morning in the States. Our teachers started teaching at 3 a.m. and they stopped at 11 a.m. And then many of them actually went to their job. So they were teaching a couple hours in the morning. Most of those teachers that we had were actually still like brick and mortar school teachers that then went to their school and taught American children. So if you know that this is your audience, you don't send them a survey. Because, you know, they're just going to explode. I don't have 30 minutes. They don't even have 30 seconds. So you grab them where they are, right? You grab them when they reach out to you. If it's positive or if they're just happy to talk to somebody because they're done with their feedback, that happened too. People would just reach out to us. Yeah, everything's nice, cool product. And then we could just like continue talking with them. You grab them at the moment where they're already interacting with you. That's why we stayed away from the survey. And I think for validation stuff where there's a lot about qualitative aspects of is like of truth kind of things, like not how much, what percentage or how, questions like how likely are you to continue using our product? Well, that's not the question at this point. Like, are you still using it or are you not? Right? This kind of stuff is more important for these kind of validation efforts, at least it was for us. So we would never really go too far into the quantitative realm.
It's good to hear that you validate my existing hypothesis that surveys are not a great way of doing that. And you either avoid them altogether or you ask super open-ended questions. And then in return, it becomes like still meaningless to have a survey in the first place because you have to manually go through the answers anyway. So that's good to hear that proof. I wonder in your scale, that context of the user being either in the early phase of trialing the product or the user who is already advanced and has been with you for 2 years. On your scale, are you mostly adopting your product for those advanced users, or like does the opinion matter of those people who are early just coming on the platform?
Well, that's a hard one to answer because obviously you want to do both as much as you can. You want to make the onboarding part or the self-onboarding, I guess, where people start to use your product as easy as possible, particularly in our case, because using Feedback Panda was something that kind of elevated your teaching to levels where you couldn't have done before. because most teachers were teaching for like 4 hours a day or maybe three because there was just so much work, extra work to do. But using our product allowed them to teach for 8 or 10 hours, which is doubling your income. And that is significant, right? So you become from somebody who may have 2 or 3 jobs, you may go to having just this one job and do it full time. So what we wanted to build a product for people who do this a lot, make it highly performant. And I know that I'm talking to user experience people here. There were a lot of problems with performance in our product for people who were using it a lot, like with just building software the way that I thought was fine enough, but and then led to it being extremely slow on people's computers that were not like a MacBook Pro from 2018 or 19, like my development system was. So I kind of had to learn that other people have different technology that they use. Also, when I built the software, I tested it, like our tables or something with a couple dozen rows maybe. But then there were teachers that had thousands of rows in their tables, making scrolling impossible, making it necessary to be able to search for stuff instead of just like kind of scanning the screen and finding it. All these kind of things I learned by talking to our most experienced users, the people that have been with us for the longest. There were people that had 5,000 or 6,000 pieces of student feedback after teaching for a year or two. And they all like had to kind of easily find which was when and what the content was. So there was a lot of learnings for me as somebody who's never built a product for people that professional in the one thing that they're doing. That yeah, really taught me the value of having these kind of conversations, because I would talk to these people because they would start complaining, this is sluggish, doesn't work anymore, I can scroll, why doesn't it load these 10,000 items within a second, what's going on? Like these kind of questions came in, but there were also questions of people that had just started, so why is this useful? And that's a totally different question, right? Because somebody who has been struggling with teaching for 4 hours a day and thinks, oh, now I need to write templates as well as feedback, right? Now, for them, the whole thing becomes more work for at least a couple days, because now all of a sudden they need to start writing the student feedback, but not like before in a text box and then send it. But they now need to write a version for the male students, a version for the female students. And for every single lesson, they needed to do that. So that taught us we need to help these people too. So what I built was a tool allowing them to translate one feedback template from male into a female version by just replacing the pronouns and stuff. Turns out that is super complicated. And I had to spend a couple weeks building a machine learning system that would reliably translate pronouns from female to male. Male to female is easier because there's like a one-to-one mapping, but the other way around is difficult because her can mean I can translate both into him and his. So that is impossible to build just with an easy substitution. So that is a feature I needed to build that came as a result of some people saying, well, this is too much work for me to start. I don't want to get started and spend hours building up my library of templates before I can actually get value from your product. So we needed to allow our product to make it very easy for them to start and then make it very easy for them to use it extremely professionally with a lot of data in the end.
This sounds like that classic story from Stephen Covey's book when, you know, I'm busy cutting the tree, I don't have time to sharpen my saw or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, that was also the reason why we built in the system that actually drove most of the growth of the product. Just really need to put this in here because I feel that was, I guess, a lucky coincidence that we thought of it. But we figured out that once you have a template as a teacher, which is essentially a male and a female version of the same text that you would then kind of have automatically have this, our system put the name in of the student and add some more things manually, and that would be your final feedback. So the template is the most important part. Once you have this as a teacher, why not share it with all the other teachers in our system? Because we noticed that people were already starting to share these kind of templates that they had written themselves outside of Feedback Panda, which was a good validation of our product, I guess, before we started the product, people had started making lists on Google Sheets with templates. People had started making their own Word documents full of templates. Everybody had their own little solution. So we just built a system that would consolidate and centralize that. So we added a sharing system. Like we called this the Feedback Panda Cloud because all these templates would essentially be shared in what was like a cloud storage system for all of our users. And that was crazy successful. People would automatically share the templates whenever they wrote one. Within weeks, we had thousands of templates. I think at the end, when we sold the company, we had like 500,000 templates shared within our system. And that obviously meant that everybody who came to our system as a new customer, we could tell them, well, if you don't want to write your own, just use one of these 4,000 templates that exist for this one particular lesson that were written by all these teachers. And we always put like how many people imported it into their own database as some kind of indicator for quality. And now we had this kind of self-regulating, self-rating system of templates that all of the thousands of our teachers were sharing amongst each other, which made it so much easier to onboard people because they didn't need to do anything. They needed to click import. They would have a full template for both male and female student versions in their system immediately that they could create feedback from. Like we literally cut short the time to the aha moment on onboarding when we wanted to get our customers to really see the value of the business, more of like paying for the service. We cut this down to what was essentially 3 to 4 minutes from maybe half an hour. And that was super efficient. Like having a network effect built into your product makes onboarding so much easier because people have value immediately. It's right there at the fingertips. And that made a lot of difference for us.
I remember you mentioned that at MicroConf, and that triggered a heated discussion between myself and Benedict, because in UserList, we have the same problem of people needing to create content. It remained hypothetical because we're not the stage to be building such features at this point, but we were wondering whether founders would be A, proud to share what they have for email automation, B, treated as a commercial secret and never share it as an email. And like both have their own legitimate sort of reasonings for that. So I guess that remains a hypothesis before you actually try and test this.
Right. Yeah. It's a tough one because trade secrets are always a problem. We never had that problem with our audience, but I see that there are obviously audiences out there that would rather die than share the kind of winning A/B tested headlines that they use for their cold outreach emails and stuff like that. Right. So I can see that this will be different from audience to audience, but there was a link that I found a couple of days ago, or was it weeks ago? It was like examples of customer service conversations. There was like this website that I found it on Twitter. I might need to find the link and maybe we can put it in the show notes or something. That was really cool because there was somebody who had collected all these kind of guides and tutorials and just examples of great customer service conversations, how to respond to people complaining, how to respond to people asking for a discount and these kind of things. I think that is an untapped resource that a lot of founders would love to share because in the end, it doesn't really hurt you. I don't think it's a trade secret to tell other founders how to they can get their customers to be happier, right? Because unless it's telling your competition that, which is, I don't know. Like, is it likely? Not sure about that. So if it were that, well, then maybe people wouldn't share. But just sharing good manners and good like practices, I think in general, if it's elective, if people can select what they share and what they don't share, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, at this point, I'm personally leaning towards the fact that the hopes that founders also share the standpoint that it's not a zero-sum game because we all target different audiences and it's more about sharing common experiences and camaraderie other than, you know, hiding from each other. But it still remains a discussion.
Yeah, and I think it's very important to discuss this because obviously this could maim your business if you did it wrong, right? This could can you lose a lot of trust with people if people were really that secretive. Right. If you then would do this and people would be yelling at other founders not to use your product because you share their secrets, that would be a problem. But just looking at the founder scene, I mean, just go to Indie Hackers, look at the milestones that people post, and you will see that people are very open with their successes and their failures, things that worked, things that didn't. In general, I would assume that people love to share and help each other because they know it's a reciprocation, right? It comes back to you. You help. And I've been noticing that in my writing. I've been writing for what is now 4.5 months on my blog. And every time I write, every time I post about an article, I've never gotten a response that was purely negative. I've got criticism, sure, but I've never got, no, this is wrong. I got, well, I don't believe that. And here is my theory. And here's what I think. Just always an enrichment of the content that I've been producing. Like the community of founders is always trying to be constructive, even though it might be criticism. It's still constructive. It's still trying to help, right? It's like learnings distilled into criticism, if you think about it. So I'd be very optimistic, but I'm generally a very optimistic person. So maybe that's a bias there.
So as we're wrapping up today's episode, firsthand, in your process of, you know, financing your customer success skills, have you been entirely self-taught, or are there any resources or blogs out there that have influenced your continuous validation skills?
I've been completely self-taught, and I hadn't read up on this ever, really. I mean, I've listened to a lot of podcasts in this space, and I've listened to, or I've read a lot of just things on Twitter and articles that I found, but never really researched it in detail. However, I've read a couple books that I might quote here, because I think there was a really good one in there called Farm Don't Hunt. That was by Guy Nerpas, which deals with customer success or customer service conversations in a sense of value nurturing, which is important, right? Telling people the value of the service that they are receiving. So I learned a lot about that. And then there was a book called Customer Success by Nick Mehta or something. I forget the name. That was also very influential, because understanding it more from like a VC-funded business perspective, but still interesting, learning how customer success at scale works, so that I could then break it down into kind of just goals that I would have for these conversations. Like, where do I want to go? But do I just want to make people happy, or do I want to find out something about my own business while they find out something about how to use the product? These kind of nuanced things I learned through these books, these two in particular.
Awesome. We're going to link to them. So as we're wrapping up, where can people find your blog online and hear more about your thoughts?
All right. Well, I had a lot of time over the last couple of months after having sold the business. So I've been going full time on the blog, a podcast, and a newsletter, all called the same, all The Bootstrap Founder. The blog is at thebootstrapfounder.com, and you can find the newsletter and the podcast there as well. I'm on Twitter at Arvid Kahl, ArvidKahl. And that's pretty much where I hang out. That in the hackers as well, same handle. If you just want to chat with me, I'm always available on Twitter, always open for DMs. And obviously, I would love it if people would check out the blog, because I write a new article at least every week. I've recently released a guide, 25,000 words, about getting your business from zero to sold, which is also the name of the guide. I'm working on actually creating a book out of this, which is now at 50-something thousand words. So I'm working on this stuff as we're speaking every single day. Every Friday, there's a newsletter coming out. So yeah, that's where you can find me, thebootstrapfounder.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Arvid, for sharing your wisdom today. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week.
Thank you. You too. It was a pleasure.